Well, I texted a friend of mine who's an exorcist. I said, this is what happened in the hotel room. This is what happened in the restaurant. What do you think's going on? He said, the enemy is just letting you know he's got his eye on you. We live in a world that is filled with mystery and the unseen. There is a tremendous spiritual battle going on all the time. We can't see it, but it's there.
Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about the deep principles and values of the people shaping our common life. Every episode, I speak to someone with some kind of public profile, and they come from a very wide range of political, metaphysical, and philosophical perspectives. If you listen long enough, you will hear people who you agree with and people who really challenge you, and that is part of the point. My guest today is Rod Dreher. Rod is an American conservative journalist living in Hungary, and he's also the author of several books, The Benedict Option, Live Not by Lies, and out this month, Living in Wonder. I really hope you enjoy listening. Rod, I want to know what bubbled up for you in response to this question about what is sacred to you.
Well, presumably we take outside of that the Christian faith. That is my most sacred thing. But aside from that, the first thing that came to mind was the innocence of children. Now, I didn't realize how important this was to me until, as a journalist back in 2001, I started writing about the Catholic sex abuse scandal, which ended up wrecking my spiritual life. But it was a fortunate fall. Maybe we can get into that later. But I was just completely undone by the way children were treated. And it brought me back to my school years as a boy and being bullied in middle school. You're about 12, 13, 14 years old then. And the feeling I had then, or the reality I lived, that the adults in charge saw what was happening and wouldn't stop it. So for me, not only the innocence of children, but the protection of the weak and vulnerable, that became a core value for me. There's also, your question made me think about how much a sense of underlying order and hierarchy is sacred to me. And this, I think, comes from having grown up in the American South. I'm from a small town in South Louisiana. And the home that I did, a very traditional home with a strong father. My dad was very much about hierarchy. And when you say that today, a lot of people think that must be scary. It wasn't. It was comforting. He was a gentle father in most respects, but he was also a strong man. And I watched the news a lot as a kid, and I was very afraid of the world outside. It was the 1970s. It was a time of great chaos. But our home felt so ordered, and not only ordered, but loving. And that gave me a sense of safety growing up. And it has helped me to understand that why it's so important to have a sense of order, especially for raising kids. It's also the case that growing up in the South, we are so much more formal than most Americans. So I grew up in a time when, and it's still the case today, when children say to adults, yes, sir, no, ma'am, that sort of thing. People from elsewhere in America think that's bizarre, but for me and for my generation, and I would say probably kids there today, again, it gives you a sense of safety. You know where you stand with people. We had in our town in the mid-70s, they built a nuclear power plant of all things. And we had a big influx of workers from the north. And they came in, their kids went to our school, flooded our local school. And Elizabeth, these children did not say, yes, sir, yes, ma'am. They called adults by their first name.
What?
I know. My sister and I, my younger sister, we couldn't even talk about it. It was, if these kids had shown up in our school with bones through their noses, it could not have been more scandalous. So, all right, maybe we took it a little too far, but that sense of order and hierarchy underlying the world made the scary parts of the world seem less so. I would also say a sense of humor is sacred to me because that is so lacking in the world today. A sense of humor goes very far with me. I would much rather be with someone who completely disagreed with me on religion and politics, but who knew how to tell a funny story or appreciate a funny story, than with someone who agrees with me, but is very grim. And I think this comes from my Uncle Murphy, who died in the 80s. He was such a joker. when I was growing up, we would go over to his house, his and my aunt's house, and you would climb the stairs to the house built on the side of a hill, and there would be a gravestone in front of the door. It said Murphy Andrew Dreher Jr., born 1932, no death date, and his epitaph. Well, he had won this in a card game. He was playing with an undertaker who couldn't pay his bill. So he said to my uncle, I'll make you a tombstone. Will that settle the debt? My uncle said, sure. And he wrote the epitaph on a cocktail napkin and forgot about it. A few months later, the undertaker calls my uncle and says, your tombstone is ready. My uncle sent his sons to North Louisiana to pick it up. And then he put it on his front doorstep. He would go out at night to pee on the tombstone. He was a big drinker. Yeah, see, you can see what kind of guy this is. This was his way of cheating death. And he even threw a party for the tombstone because he said, I'm not going to be here to enjoy my wake, so we may as well have a party now. Well, when he died in the 80s, his kids said, we have to put this on his grave. So if you go to the cemetery, the little country cemetery where I'm from, you'll see this tombstone with the epitaph, this ain't bad once you get used to it.
Nice.
So a sense of humor is hugely important to me. Finally, I would have said family and place because those were sacred to me. And then when my younger sister died in 2011, I moved with my wife and kids back to my hometown in Louisiana from Philadelphia, not because I particularly wanted to live in a little village on the river, but because I wanted to be around my family and to serve them and to raise my children around family. But when we got there, we realized that my family rejected us. They did not welcome us. It was a close family growing up, but it turns out that I had changed too much for them. And they thought I had betrayed them by being different. Now, mind you, we were all religious. We were all more or less conservative. But the fact that we were city people, as my late sister had raised her children to believe, meant that we were not to be trusted. This absolutely gobsmacked me. I developed a chronic autoimmune disease, Epstein-Barr, which is mononucleosis. The doctors didn't know if I was ever going to recover. This, in turn, caused the collapse of my marriage. And I spent 10 years, my now ex-wife and I, struggling with the marriage. And I came to see, trying to figure out what was happening to us, that my late father and my late sister, they made idols of family and place, so much so that they could not accept me and my family back because we deviated too much from the structure that they needed to make sense of the world. And so, tragically, that ended up destroying the whole family and even my marriage. And so I got divorced in 2022. I still think family and place are very important, but I was able to see through my own sickness and through reading Dante, of all people. God really helped me deal with my sickness by reading Dante and taking it deeply into my heart. I came to see that one of the reasons I'd been hit so hard by this was I had made an idol of family and place and my father, who was the embodiment of both. Once I realized what had happened to me, and also, by the way, realized during all this that I had never really thought that God the Father loved me. I knew he loved me because he's God the Father. He has to. But I knew he was very disappointed in me. Once during reading Dante and praying my way through all this, I realized that I had inadvertently confused my father here on earth with God the Father. And I repented of that. I took it to confession, actually, and said, I need to confess this. Everything began to change for me, and I was able to accept the love of God because I realized God is not my dad. And there's a happy story here. My dad apologized to me before he died, and I was holding his hand as he died at home. And so that was good. But this was, I bring this up only to say that family and place, having, I'd made them too sacred, and that was one of the great, great disasters of my life.
Mm, I think that's a really helpful insight, Rod, because I ask people what's sacred to them to surface these deep guiding principles that we all have, but we very rarely talk about. And as a way of building our ability to understand each other and have curiosity and empathy towards people who might be coming from very different political or metaphysical worldviews to us, not because I think the sacred is always wholly good, right? It really depends what we choose to live by. Can you think of a time where one of those values has been compromised or challenged, or you've had to use it to guide yourself in your life?
Well, you know, I remember taking some years ago, have you heard of Jonathan Haidt's Moral Foundations Test?
Yeah, where the taste buds theory thing.
It made so much clear to me about the way I had navigated through life. And as it turns out, you know, they, for listeners and viewers who don't know, Haidt believes that all humans base their worldview, their moral worldview, on a series of intuitions, one of which is harm and care, the idea of how powerful that should be. There is fairness, there's loyalty, there's authority, and there's purity or sanctity. Well, I took this test and I scored way, way over the average on all of them except loyalty, where I was under the average. And I thought that was really interesting. But you know what it did? It made me understand why I reacted the way I did to the Catholic sex abuse scandal. I had been a Catholic. I was a Catholic convert at age 26, very strongly believing Catholic for a long time, or a decade at least, when I had to start writing about the sex abuse scandal as a journalist in New York. And I really thought that as long as I had all of the syllogisms clear in my head, that my faith could withstand anything. But it wasn't true. Being exposed to these stories about the horrific sex crimes against these children and bishops who covered it up and tried to grind families down, Elizabeth, this just pushed all of my buttons on the moral foundations thing, but especially purity and authority. Because for me, as I mentioned earlier, the idea of an underlying moral order in the world that was guaranteed in my own family life by our father, and the idea of sanctity, of purity, particularly of children, that was just overwhelming. And it ended up breaking me as a Catholic. I just talking to people, like I remember this farmer, Horace, I forget his name, he's in Kansas, and his son Eric killed himself, Eric Patterson, he killed himself at age 19, and they found out just before he murdered himself that he had been abused by a priest. Turns out there were 5 suicides connected to this same priest in the Diocese of Wichita, Kansas, and the diocese had known about this priest, but just kept moving him around. The priest died in prison a few years ago. But this was the first time I, as a journalist, had encountered something like that. And I remember sitting in my office in New York City with Horace on the phone telling me this story. And I just went numb because I was a new father then. My firstborn, my son was at home. And I knew that I was in different territory. Well, years go by. And finally, by 2005, I was so filled with rage and fear that I couldn't do it anymore as a Catholic. I had lost all sense of belief in the authority of the Catholic Church. And it was like trying to hold on to an iron skillet over a flame, right? And I just couldn't do it anymore. My wife is in the same boat. She came to me crying and said, "I feel like for the first time in my life, I'm losing Jesus." She had been raised Southern Baptist in Texas. And she had converted to Catholicism because of me. So we ended up becoming Eastern Orthodox, but I was a very different kind of Orthodox Christian. I don't regret at all my crusade as a journalist to clean the church up, but I had to lessen my respect for authority, for church authority, just so I could hold on to Christ. And so as an Orthodox Christian, I have tried very hard to stay away from the institutional church, except when I have to do it. And I have realized, too, that as a Catholic, I was really intellectually arrogant. That's not the Catholic Church's fault. That's me. And I've realized, don't be that guy. Don't be triumphalist. And instead, spend more time praying and fasting and trying to be a kind person and less time with your head stuck in theology books.
Hi, I wondered if I could ask for your help. You may have noticed that we've been doing a lot of work behind the scenes to make this channel more beautiful, more enriching, more thought-provoking, and more life-giving. But 87% of you watching on this channel are not yet subscribed. So I wondered if you would just hit the little subscribe button. It means that you'll get these really thoughtful conversations in your feed, and it will also help other people find us. Thanks very much.
I just want to fill in some gaps of your story for listeners who won't be familiar with it, because we've seen this picture of you growing up in Louisiana being very, you know, polite, deferential to your family and your elders. You've spoken about feeling like a little bit of an outsider there, you know, not into hunting, real Europhile, bookish. A lot of listeners will recognize themselves. So quite a nerdy audience in a good way. There are people. And this thread of writing, of either writing journalism, investigative journalism, now with your Substack and your books, has been your kind of vocational activity, I guess. How do you think of it? What are you trying to do with it?
That's a great question. And I guess I've never sat down and thought about the capital M mission. I just write. I love telling stories. I'm so curious about the world. So I guess that my, insofar as I have a mission, it is not only to tell stories about the world, but to comprehend the world, to understand the world, and to talk about how we should understand the world, and even come to think of it, how we should live in an ordered way towards that world. You know, what is the right way to treat the natural world? What is the right way to treat others? How should we think about the food we eat, the people we love, that sort of thing? I believe that there is a mystery. There are many mysteries buried in the world outside our head. And I think my writing, my vocation as a writer has been to explore those mysteries and to maybe make them clear to people or help draw other people into them, as I myself have been drawn into them.
That's really helpful, this kind of understanding this world and the storytelling. And you've done it, you know, by writing about crunchy cons, which for UK listeners are kind of, we don't use the crunchy, sort of hippie cons, you know, environmentally aware, homegrown conservatives we might think of for a long time. You've done it by this kind of investigative journalism, the film criticism. And then my understanding is that you really reached a much higher level of prominence through this book, The Benedict Option, which lots of people have opinions about that haven't read, is my what I've come to realize.
Don't they now? Yeah.
And my kind of understanding of what it said from not having read it is now different from having engaged with it properly. Could you just say in short form, what was the argument of that book?
Well, the argument of the book is that we are living in a time today that is akin to the fall of the Roman Empire in the West. There is a sense of cultural dissolution and a sense of a loss of the things that unite us and help us make sense of the world, the loss of our story. And I thought about St. Benedict of Nursia, who emerged out of that, and he ended up going to the city of Rome, realizing it was chaotic. He was going to lose his faith if he stayed there. And he ended up retreating to a cave and prayed and thought and wrote The Rule of St. Benedict, which was a simple manual for how to run a monastery, which is to say a community, a tight community that was an island of safety and order in a time of chaos and dissolution. Well, I began to wonder if St. Benedict were alive today, what would he have to say to us? Because, as I should have said, Elizabeth, the Benedictine monks, they spread like wildfire throughout the Middle Ages, and they were one of the main forces that helped bring civilization back to Europe. So I'm wondering, what would St. Benedict have to say to us today? Because most of us are not called to the monastery. But how can we live in ways that keep us focused on the faith and allow us to create a habitus, a way of living, so we can live the faith out in this time, this post-Christian era of chaos? And in the book, I talk about all the different ways we might do that. But as you've said earlier, people who never read the book thought I was saying we have to head for the hills, like St. Benedict, and live in a cave. I never said that. It's not possible. There is no escape. But if we are going to be faithful Christians for this post-Christian world, then we Christians are going to have to live in different, more intentional and disciplined ways so we can be for the world whom Christ wants us to be.
So it's probably helpful here to communicate a real point of similarity with us in that I'm speaking to you from a very small intentional community. And the funny thing is, I'd never read your book because I had assumed I wouldn't like you for those aforementioned reasons that my kind of understanding of how myself as a Christian, lots of readers aren't Christians, but I'm hoping this is still going to make listeners aren't Christian. I hope this is going to make sense. My posture as a Christian was not retreat from the world, but an attempt to serve it, right? To be loving my neighbor, but that to do that, I needed some deep roots, right? And so we have, we're not officially Benedictine, but Benedictine inspired rule of life. We've turned the garage into a chapel. We do morning prayer. We do complaint. We do hospitality. And we also got there. My husband is a philosopher from reading the end of After Virtue and Alistair McIntyre.
That's where I got it.
Yeah. The last paragraph in the first edition. And then in the second or third edition, when he does the updated preface, there's another like ending paragraph, which is one of the most inspirational things we'd ever read. So it's been really interesting to me how public conversations work and where we position each other and the stories that we tell about each other. And I guess I wanted to just reflect a bit on one possible just temperamental difference or posture difference about what are these communities for? So we've made ours in the city. And deliberately so, because it felt like the kind of classic, both as Christians or as the more kind of countercultural type commons do, the desire to sort of pull the escape cord and move to rural areas is really strong. And that is some people's charism, right? That is their calling. Brilliant. But for me, it felt like the city is, not least the Bible starts in a garden and ends in a city, but that it is, that there is something about being amongst our neighbours so that we know their needs, right? So that we are... we have shared vulnerabilities, right? That we have a stake in our civil cloth of where we live. We need the deep roots so that we can maintain our particularity, but then we need this hospitality. We need the open doors. We need to be porous. I guess the difference in our posture is maybe national and is about in the UK, we never really have been the majority for a long time. And so I don't feel this strong sense of like, the shaping of Christian ideas have ebbed. I feel like they were ebbing a long time ago, for better or worse. And also a desire to move towards the culture through these communities rather than away from it. Does that make any sense? I'm afraid there's sort of some random threads in there, but maybe I could just say what it makes you think about.
Well, I one of the things I try to bring out in the Benedict Option book is the idea that not everyone is called to the same thing. I mean, as we've been talking, I was raised in the country, could not wait to get out, and I tried to move back. It didn't work spectacularly. So insofar as I could live in a Benedict Option, it would need to be an urban one. And some people are made that way. Others, like my friend Paul Kingsnorth, you know, I visited him and his wife and kids out in rural Ireland. That was a man who was made for the country because he loves the natural world. Me, that's where the snakes are and the bugs and the alligators and Bigfoot. I think that we do have to follow where God calls us and play to our own strengths. At the same time, even living in the country, I mean, where I grew up, my parents' house, we had an open door. We were always having people over, cooking for them. My parents were beloved in the community, and I really learned a lot from them about why it's important to cook for people and to have people stay over till after midnight, even on a school night or a work night, if the conversation is good. So that is something that can be with us wherever we live. And oddly enough, the loneliest I've ever been, I have to say, has probably been living in a city. You know, when you realize, especially not so much where I live now, I live in the heart of Budapest, but living in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in a, you know, sort of in the city, but in a suburban type subdivision where you don't even know your neighbors. So this loneliness is not so much a matter of where we live, but how we choose to live. I do think, and it's important to emphasize that your attitude towards serving the world, that's what I think of when I think of the Benedict Option, not withdrawing from it. But as you say, I mean, it sounds perfect what you're doing. I didn't know this about you until just now. But
it's definitely not perfect.
No. But I mean,
watching it together.
No, the idea that we withdraw from the world so we can be Christ for the world in an authentic way. One of the monks in Norcia, St. Benedict's hometown, where there's a monastery that was refounded in the year 2000, one of the Norcia monks said, listen, we have thousands of people who come here as pilgrims. They come for the mass. They come for spiritual direction, all sorts of things. And we love having them. We want to serve them. But if we don't follow the rule and close our doors and go into prayer and scripture reading and doing our work according to the rule, then we're not going to be able to help them when they come to us with their problems. There's a lot of wisdom there. You know, we look in scripture, Christ would go into the wilderness to pray and fast before he would go out to minister. There's a rhythm of life that requires withdrawing and then going forth. And I have found in my own life, there are times when I just have to shut the laptop and read and be quiet so I can know what I think.
I'd love to hear, you know, you mentioned that you now live in Budapest, and I know that that's part of a longer journey that you've referenced about this conversion to Eastern Orthodoxy. And I'd love to hear both what you think was the kind of deciding factor for you and why we are seeing that path. And maybe there have been quietly always being converts, but it feels like more and more public people, thinkers in the public square, are finding the same thing as you, that this is the spiritual tradition in which they can find their home. What do you think is going on there?
That's a great question. I became Orthodox in 2006 because for my wife and me as Catholics, we believed, as the Catholic Church teaches, that the Orthodox Church has valid sacraments, the idea of the real presence in the Eucharist. That's there in Orthodoxy. And we began to visit the Orthodox Cathedral in Dallas, Texas, where we were living, not intending to convert, but because we wanted to be in the real presence, though we couldn't receive communion without this overwhelming fear and anger that we had at the Catholic Church. And I got there and realized, Elizabeth, that, wait a minute, this is what I thought the Catholic Church was going to be when I converted as a young man. This overwhelming sense of reverence and transcendence in the liturgy. The sense, because so often in the American Catholic Church anyway, you get this, you know, Father Glad-handing who's there to tell a joke, and you just feel like, dude, take this seriously, please, would you? But we had that sense of reverence, and it was a tactile reverence. You know, there was so much incense, so many icons, candles, things that you have in the Catholic Church, but not like in the Orthodox Church where it's overwhelming. And my wife said to me, you can go back to Catholicism if you want, but this is my home. And I realized, yeah, this is my home too now. What's happening, Elizabeth, is that people are so desperate for a sense of the transcendent and the sense of something old. When COVID happened in the U.S., in our little Orthodox parish in Baton Rouge, we suddenly saw this influx of young people, people in their 20s, some married, some not. And we would tell them, we're happy you're here, but what brought you here? Well, it turns out that COVID scared them. They began to see that the world is far more fragile than they thought it was. And they told us that they were coming mostly out of suburban evangelicalism. They said, we know we need a deeper tradition for hard times ahead. And they saw that Orthodoxy has withstood the test of time. But it's also the case that it is, as I was mentioning, the sense of beauty and the sense of God's presence in beauty. It's just overwhelming. And also, I should say, the saints. I mean, in Orthodoxy, we have such a rich tradition of the saints, as does Catholicism. But in Orthodoxy, it seems like the saints of the early church and the patristic period are much more emphasized. And when you read their stories and you read the stories of their martyrdom, there's something that draws people into that. They want to know what kind of faith, experience of faith, gave people the courage to live and to die this way. And in my own case too, the thing that finally pushed me to convert was something like 6 or 7 years after this event in Chartres. I met an elderly Catholic Monsignor who was so saintly. He radiated light and joy. He was in his 90s. And I went to interview him for the paper and asked him about his conversion. And he had had two miracles that happened to him many, many decades earlier that brought him back from atheism and then sent him to the priesthood. And when that old man talked about this. His tears were coming down his cheeks like it had happened last week. I realized sitting there 24 years old as someone who was convinced of Christianity but was afraid to submit, I said, this old man was a witness. He changed his life in a radical way because of what he saw. I've got to change my life too. I can't put it off anymore. So you have this bookend of the encounter with beauty and the encounter with radical goodness and the person of this Monsignor. And that's what made the propositions of Christianity come alive for me. And I think in Orthodoxy, you can have that to an incredibly intense degree today. And that's what's drawing people.
Yeah. Let's talk about wonder then. And I really liked the line in your acknowledgement where you said Ross Douthat had said to you, you need to write your woo book. It's a fascinating exploration of some things that a lot of, I think, mainstream readers are going to be like, wow, we're really in it now. What felt so important for you to write about? What does it mean to live in an enchanted world and to posture ourselves towards it in ways that maybe humans did for centuries and we've possibly forgotten how to do?
Well, you know, I've been telling woo stories about exorcism, about miracles, things that I've encountered or people I've come to know have encountered for years. And you can really, you know, get a room in the palm of your hand when you tell these stories. And I was wondering, what's the point of them? Why should they matter to people? And I think they should matter to people because they reveal a hidden order. They reveal that there is transcendence, that the world is not what we think it is. I've lived that way for almost my entire Christian life because I happen to be a weirdo magnet. You know, I attract people who have these stories, but also they've happened to me. I mean, I'll give you a mild example. When I was in Rome for Pope Benedict XVI's funeral a couple of years ago, I was in my hotel room getting ready to go down to St. Peter's Square early the morning for the funeral. I heard this crash behind me and I whirled around and my desk chair was sitting in a pile of pipes and fabric. It was not a wooden chair. It was not an old chair, but I noticed that a bolt that it was holding it all together had been sheared in two. I thought, good Lord, but I don't have time to think about it. I've got to get down to St. Peter's. The funeral happened. And I was really angered by the homily Pope Francis gave, which I thought was really disrespectful to Pope Benedict, a man I revere. That afternoon, I met some two American journalists who covered the Vatican at a restaurant in Vatican City. And we were talking about what happened. And both of these men were telling me how difficult as Catholics their jobs were covering the Vatican because, as they agreed, so little about what happens in that place has anything to do with Jesus Christ. Well, then I told them the story about the weird thing that happened in my room that morning. As I told the story, Elizabeth, the unoccupied chair at the table flips over backwards. No one was sitting on it, and everyone just fell silent. Well, I texted a friend of mine who's an exorcist in the Vatican. I said, this is what happened in the hotel room. This is what happened in the restaurant. What do you think's going on? He said, the enemy is just letting you know he's got his eye on you. And that's a small story. I've got some big ones that come out in the book. But it's just a reminder that we live in a world that is filled with mystery and the unseen. There's a story in the book about a Catholic couple I knew, friends from my New York days, who the woman, Emma, I call her in the book, was possessed, you know, and found out she was possessed late in life. It's a long story. I won't get into it here, but I remember asking her, these are Upper East Side people, right? Fancy people. The husband works in finance. They were faithful church-going Catholics, and yet this happened. I remember her husband, Nathan, walking me back to my hotel after I visited them, and she manifested demonically in front of me. I said, how has this changed you, this whole crazy experience of working with an exorcist and your wife? He said, now when I walk down the street in Manhattan, I realize there is a tremendous spiritual battle going on around me all the time, and we can't see it, but it's there. This long roundabout answer to your question is, I want people to be aware of this, that this is really going on, that as St. Paul says, we really struggle against principalities and powers. But not only the dark side of it, but the light side of it. I mean, there's a story I tell in the book. You know the story about Stefano, the young Roman guy raised in an atheist family, communist family, hated God, but then mysterious synchronicities began to happen to him. And he's getting out of his car one day. He was 19 years old with his cousin. It was just before Christmas. They were going to a party, and he sees this homeless man across the street. The homeless man looks at him in the eye, rises up, walks over to him and said, "Stefano, I finally found you. Jesus Christ sent me, and he wants you to know that you don't have to be afraid anymore. From this day, you will serve him." And then the homeless man begins telling Stefano about his whole life. Stefano told me he was crying. He couldn't figure this out. What's going on? He told me even that if his cousin had not been standing there watching and listening to this, he would have thought he hallucinated it. Stefano asked the homeless man, "Are you an angel?" No answer, just a smile. He said, "Well, what's your name?" The man said, "You can call me Felice de Natale, Merry Christmas." This was right before Christmas. Then Merry Christmas falls on his knees, raises his hands, and begins to say the Our Father. And after each line, he would add these praises, elaborate praises of God. He finishes, stands up, bows, walks away, and disappears. Well, Stefano converted. He converted his entire family, even his hardcore atheist father on his deathbed. Those stories happen. They really do happen. And I can sit there and tell people, give them an apologetic argument for Christianity all day long, and they can just flick it away. But you tell them a story like that, and they listen. It opens doors in their hearts and minds.
Yes, it was really interesting reading, because one of the things that I'm write and speak about a lot is just the centrality of encounter. I'm a kind of charismatic Christian. I have kind of started there and then lost my faith and then found my way back to something very austere and rational and intellectual. And now I'm really very, I find it quite mischievous, because I'm often speaking about these things in settings that are not Christian or Christians, but scared of this bit. And talking about, you know, I went to church on Sunday and had a really big cry and a dance and needed to speak in tongues, because of my sense that the transcendent and the mysterious and the these moments of encounter and breaking through are, I think you use the line, the sort of heart of all true religion, or the center of all true religion. And I think we're moving from a moment where I was saying the other day that, with my more sort of sociology of religion hat on, and I spend a lot of time listening to people outside the church, that we're moving from the non-religious default being kind of atheisty, although more like agnosticy, to the default amongst the non-religious, particularly amongst younger people and particularly amongst women, partly I think driven by the climate crisis and by psychedelics, to more default pagany. And pagany is not a helpful sociological category, but it's the best I've got at the moment. And what I'm observing in my friends who are not who are non-religious or outside the church, this real up, particularly among young women, this uptick in interest in astrology and tarot, and, you know, people talk about themselves being witchy. And what your book made me think is that there is something, you know, related or parallel or reacting to willingness in the church to talk more explicitly about what has always been the sort of orthodox cosmology of angels and demons. Essentially, what do you think is driving? Why now? Why is this moment of what you see as being a kind of re-enchantment of the world happening?
Yeah, you know, as I write in the book, one of the big turning points in this project was when a young Anglican ordinand, Daniel Kim, approached me in Oxford a couple of years ago and told me just what you said. He said to me, your generation, Rod, I'm in my mid-50s, your generation thinks that the new atheism is a default. That's not the case anymore with my generation. He was 27 at the time. And he said just what you did, that they're turning to the occult. Well, I think what they're doing here is, and also Christians, younger Christians and Generation Z, who are turning to the more numinous focused Christian traditions, is they realize that rationalism is not enough. You know, that it's very dry, and moralism is not enough either. I remember back in, 2014, I think it was, I was talking to a sociologist of religion in the U.S., Christian Smith, who's done the most work about the religious lives of younger people. And he was the one who came up with the term that many people know now, moralistic therapeutic deism. And he said, this is a de facto religion of young people in America, whatever their tradition is. And it's a very shallow, weak form of religion that tells you God exists. He wants you to be nice. You only have to call on him when you need something. And
you're a good person.
Yeah, right. And it's very therapeutic, but it is moralistic too. But it's not Christian, whatever it is. I think, Elizabeth, that people, or a certain number of people, are finally getting fed up with that. And if they can't find a connection to the transcendent, a real connection, not just an idealistic connection, if they can't feel and experience God and the holy and worship and otherwise, then they're going to turn to these pagan religions and even the occult outright that will enable them to do that. As this exorcist in Rome told me, he said, the thing is, when you call on the demonic, it will come. It will destroy you, but it will come. You can have these experiences if you want them. God doesn't work that way. God is real. Sometimes God does send angels to help us or works with us through the miraculous. But God cannot be commanded like, you know, you send up the prayer and then down comes the miracle. It doesn't work that way, but we can connect with God. And I think that whether it's through Pentecostalism or charismatic forms of Catholicism or Anglicanism or through Orthodoxy, the religious traditions that will focus on the weird and the woo and the supernatural, which is there, look at the Bible for heaven's sake, they're the ones that are appealing to people today. I love Tom Holland the other day told Justin Brierley that Christians ought to be leaning into the supernatural because that's the greatest gift you have to give the world today.
Thank you. I want to try something, and I need to premise it with, we haven't met in person, although you've been living in my head for weeks. So I'm so sorry.
I hope I've kept a tidy place. I mean,
yep. You've been very polite, very, very southern. So I speak to people for this podcast from radically different worldviews. And I always start with my kind of two-dimensional place, semiotic placeholder for them in my head. And then in the research and then in the conversation, that complicates. And so the things that I think I will be in a different place to them sometimes change. I'll find more things in common than I thought. But the point of these kind of conversations is not what you often find in podcast land, is people just talking to people they completely agree with, or people arguing with people they completely disagree with. And I'm trying to do something slightly different, which is seek to understand. And I think the key place where we have some difference is in our political postures, or maybe just our political intuitions. And I want to ground it in, I'm wondering if it's connected to what you said about your sacred values and the first two, which were the protection of the vulnerable and then order and hierarchy. And so the key thing I'd love you to try and help me understand, and I really need to know this, is it's not adversarial. I really want to understand.
That's fine. Yeah.
I'm curious, is let's narrow it down to, and I was listening to you talking about Andrew Sullivan. I know that you're not planning to vote for Trump in any simple way where you think he's a good guy, but that it's a kind of pragmatic decision, but that's where you're headed politically with him. And then writing about Viktor Orban and his approach to immigration and some of the things going on in Hungary. My political theology is complicated. I don't know what I am. I thought I was a post-liberal, but now I just don't believe you can ever be post anything. So I'm just an accumulation of everything.
Call Mary Harrington. She'll get you sorted.
Thanks. Yeah. I spoke to her too. She's so interesting. But I know that one of my key kind of bricks in my political theology is this, the quartet of the vulnerable from Brueggemann. This leitmotif in the Hebrew Bible, the poor, the widow, the orphan, and the alien and the stranger. And so what I react to in both Trump and Orban is a sense that their posture towards the vulnerable, I can't see it as connected to where my faith is coming from. So given we're starting from the same premises, I'd love to just hear more about that bit of your political intuitions, your worldview, how it connects to your faith.
That's my question. I should start out by making clear to your listeners, I am going to vote for Trump, but I'm not doing it with any confidence in Trump. I don't think he's a good man. I think he's a destructive man, but I think he represents lesser destruction than the Democratic Party does. But I write about politics, but I have no faith in politics anymore. I'm much more interested in religion and culture. But if you're talking about the vulnerable, I'm presuming you mean immigrants, right? Is that what you're
so
mostly?
So of those four, that one that's the alien and the stranger is what I think mm-hmm. about in mm-hmm. that one, yeah.
Yeah, well, I should preface this too by saying that my kind of conservatism doesn't really jive with mainstream American conservatism, which is more like right-wing liberalism in the sense the free market and all that. My conservatism has always been more European, more Catholic influence in the sense that I believe the good society is a society that makes, as Peter Maurin said, makes it easy to be good and that serves the family, you know, helping the family get along. And that's the kind of thing I would like, the changes I would like to see happen in the Republican Party in the U.S. But about the migrant thing, we can't have an ordered community if we can't control who comes in to that community. Here in Budapest, you know, Hungary is often criticized for having a very strict anti-migrant policy. But we get people coming here to Budapest from the UK and Western Europe who walk around and they're like, this feels like Europe used to be. You don't have the crime that has accompanied so much migration. And people, there's a sense of order here that doesn't require police on every street corner. You don't see police often at all here, but there's just this unspoken sense of order that because the people here share so much in common. Now, I do believe that as Christians, a government has a duty of care to help those who are suffering. The people coming out of the Middle East, for example, in 2015, they had a right to our help, but that doesn't mean they have a right to come into our country and settle there. I had a visit this summer with an American guy who had been a student in Germany the last 2 years. He said, you know, it's so striking here in Budapest to see women walking alone in the street, even late at night, and they're safe. He said, that doesn't happen in Germany. And I said, why doesn't it? Well, migration. And a lot of these men come from cultures that are very aggressive towards women. Well, who is the vulnerable in this case? Aren't women vulnerable? You know, the women who actually live there? That's where I come from. I don't believe at all in cruelty to migrants, but I don't believe that we should be so open to migrants that we neglect to protect the people who are actually our neighbors today. That's where that comes from. But the demonization of migrants as, you know, subhuman, of course, that's evil, and I would never support that.
Thank you. That really helps me understand. And maybe trying to tie together some of these themes, what would it mean, you know, as we look at your kind of the crunchy con stuff and the Benedict option, and then this real beautiful call towards enchantment and living in wonder. What is your hope for how Christians might engage in public in these times where we're so divided and so quick to assume the worst of each other, quick to hate each other, quick to move away from each other rather than towards each other?
Oh, you ask the hard questions. I think, and this is going to sound trite maybe, but I think we just have to be as fully ourselves in the public square as we can be as Christians. One of the things I learned from doing Live Not By Lies, which is a book about the people who came to the West to escape Soviet communism, are now amid the Great Awakening, starting to see some of the things they ran away from rising in a very different key in the West. In other words, you have to be afraid of what you say, you could have your life ruined, and so forth. Well, I wrote a book to explore what they meant by that, but also the second half of that book was about traveling throughout the former Soviet bloc, asking Christians who stayed behind, how should we then live? And one of the key thing I found is you have to be willing to suffer publicly. Why is that? Because that's how you prove what your faith is. I remember talking to this woman, Kamila Bendova, in Prague. She and her late husband, Václav, were the only Christians in the inner circle of Václav Havel and the other top dissidents. And I remember asking her, I said, Kamila, was it difficult for you and your husband to be part of this circle? Because Havel and the others, they were all hippies on the left, and Kamila and her husband definitely were not. She said, no, Rod, it was not hard at all, because when you're faced with the sort of thing we were all facing, the greatest thing you need to look for in other people, in the people you draw close to, is courage. She said, you mustn't imagine that our fellow Catholics had courage. Most of them didn't. They kept their heads down and wanted to stay out of trouble. But my husband and I felt that we couldn't live that way as Christians. We had a moral duty to God and to the community and to our own children to stand up and protest. And we knew the ones who would stand by us were Havel and this other crowd. They would look after our children if we got sent to prison and so on and so forth. So, but from
wow,
that...
that's quite a statement to be able to say, isn't it?
Yeah. And I took that to heart, and I think we all have to take it to heart, but the importance of suffering, willingness to suffer, that is the key aspect of our Christian witness today. And we don't have gulags now. Nobody's going to prison yet, although in the UK, it's things seem to be accelerating, but nobody's going to prison for their faith yet. Nevertheless, it's hard to stand in the public squares and speak metaphorically and to proclaim your Christian faith, especially in ways that conflict with what the broader culture believes. Because we are in a post-liberal time when people don't are completely intolerant. If you hold a traditional Christian view on abortion, on sexuality, and so on, if we can bear witness through suffering and through suffering well, meaning joyfully, I think that's very powerful to people. This is not to say run into the middle of, you know, Piccadilly Circus and start ranting at people. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about bearing witness in small ways through acts of kindness and mercy and forgiveness. This is something that I struggle with myself because I have I can have a quick temper. I'm very sharp with words. People always say to me, oh, I didn't know you were actually such a nice guy because of the way you write. I'm like, God, I need to work on that. But it's really true, though. I think this, going back to my dad, even though my dad and my family and I had a really bad falling out, seeing how much my parents, even though they had strong views, cared about people around them really made a difference to me. I remember when I was in college, you know, my father, born in 1934 in a rural part of the Deep South, he had all the racial views you would expect of people of that generation. And I would come home from college in the 80s and lecture him with the Ciceronian ardor about the wrongness of his views. The thing is, it occurred to me later, is that I held all the quote-unquote correct views about race, but I never lifted a finger to help an actual Black person. My father had all the incorrect views about race, but there were lots of poor Black people who lived around us. My dad was helping them. He would help them out, and he didn't see a contradiction there. It was a rebuke to me when I got older and less self-righteous to think that pay more attention to what people do than what they say and they believe. My dad saw, even though he was a racist, he saw his duty to help his fellow man who was suffering. And the older I get, the more I see how morally complicated people's lives are, and my own life is, the more I see that the act is better than the idea.
There's so much more we could dig into, but I want to honor your time today. So, Rod Dreher, thank you so much for speaking to me for The Sacred.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay, my first reflection is how jolly and friendly Rod was. And various people had warned me of this, that the persona that you get on the page is very different from the persona from the person when you meet them. Because I'm sure Rod would be the first one to say this. In fact, I've heard him say it, that his writing is often quite melancholic and sometimes quite chippy. And as you have heard, that's not how he presents in person when you encounter him. And honestly, that's just lovely, right? It's much easier to build a connection with someone who's showing up with that kind of friendly and open energy. My second reflection is around this re-enchantment of the world, which is the argument of Lost in Wonder. Living in Wonder. And I've also heard Rod use this phrase, the old gods are rising. And there is this sense in this book, this argument that the unseen, which was just not part of the social imaginary
of the last century or so, at least, is coming back into focus. And you know, he's right in describing it as his woo book. And you know, bear in mind, I'm someone who is pretty comfortable with the transcendent and with some of these themes. I'm far from being a kind of skeptical materialist rationalist. However, even for me, some of it's quite challenging, right? He has a whole chapter on aliens and how alien, what might be the relationship between aliens and the demonic, and another one on AI and what might be the kind of spiritual element of AI, which is not something I'd ever thought about. Never really thought about aliens either. And a lot on exorcisms and, what is really a kind of orthodox cosmology within my faith and the norm for many centuries, but is still an area that I think a lot of us just don't know quite how to handle. And it contrasted obviously with speaking to an earlier guest in the series, Dr. Kate Thomas, who also is very, speaks in the language of the unseen, of kind of forces at work. And her frame is much more about magic. So it's been really interesting kind of as I'm prepping for both of these interviews to be living in this sense of like, oh, there is possibly a sort of re-enchantment happening. And in some ways, we might find we've bitten off more than we can chew. Like those of us who've sort of longed for a re-enchanted world, I think there's complex things to be thinking about. And I'm also left thinking about what is the line actually between magic and prayer? Because, I mean, at some place in the book, Rod explicitly frames it like that, like the priest had stronger magic than, you know, whatever these kind of evil spirits they were trying to counter were. And one of the interests that we have in common that we talked about was monasticism as a way of building these morally formative and resilient communities of mutual care that can love their neighbours. And as part of our monastic practice in our house, we pray Compline. And Compline is this, it's the lullaby of the liturgy. It's this short night prayer before bed. And I've been reading a book by Patrick Leifer Moore called A Time of Great Silence, sort of one of the great pieces of travel writing written in the mid-20th century. And he is, I don't think, or at that point at all, a Christian, but goes to stay in these ancient monasteries and writes about them. And this is what he writes about Compline. Compline, the office that finishes the monastic day, belongs more than any of them to the world of the medieval church. Only one lamp is lighted, enough for the monk who reads aloud from the rule of St. Benedict. The faces of the seated monks are hidden in their hoods, their heads bowed, and they themselves are only just discernible under the accumulation of shadows. The whole service is a kind of precautionary exorcism of the terrors of the night, a warding off of the powers of darkness, each word throwing up a barrier or shooting home a bolt against the prowling regions of the evil one. One by one, the keys turn in the wards, the portcullises fall, the invisible drawbridges touch the battlements, the windows are barred against the lurking incubus, the pre-8th century iambic diameters seal up any remaining loopholes against the invasion of the hovering succubi. Such a great writer. And it really made me see how when we're praying Compline, that honestly it feels like that's part of what we're doing. Like, my dear ones, O Lord, bless thou and keep in every place when they are. We're praying a blessing, which feels honestly a bit like a spell of protection over my children, right? Around our household and community. And Patrick Lee's form are kind of like each prayer is a portcullis dropping around the household. It's making me quite emotional, which is interesting. Yeah, that sense of it comes out of a time that was stranger than us. I'm just left with really pondering the way I've been living in these things in this series. And the final thing with Rod is to name something, which is that I found it more emotionally and intellectually turbulent preparing for this podcast than for most, because every guest I talk to, I have some things in common with and some things that are different or that I disagree with or I don't understand. But with Rod, it was like both of those things had been turned up to 11. we both have a huge amount in common. It's very rare that I meet someone who is a sort of interested in and versed in monasticism as me, but he also talks about beauty. He writes about the sacred. You know, he writes about the kind of erotic element of spirituality, as I said, very unusual that anyone else goes there. There's passages in his book that I was like, oh, I've written something really similar to that, or I could have written that. I was sort of nodding along vigorously. Not all of it, by a long way, but sufficiently to it that I felt this really strong, like, oh, there's loads we can talk about that we have in common. And a probable equal amount of dissonance, of disagreement, of radically different intuitions. Not so much in that book, because that book doesn't really go there. In fact, what I'm noticing is none of his books quite go there in the same way that some of his Substack and his public profiles do. But this radically different political theology, essentially, that could lead him to see in Trump and Orban leaders that the world needs, right, that might serve the common good. And I know that there's, you know, there's complexity around that. It's not that he thinks they're great guys, but it, yeah, my intuitions about the kind of leaders that we need to build a just world, and particularly for this care of the vulnerable that I see as such a strong thread in the Christian ethic in general. The alien and the stranger, those on the outside. And I obviously asked one question about it, but I think what I would love maybe if Rod is willing to, is to have a longer conversation, because I think actually we might be able to have enough similarity and enough respect to have a conversation where we're really seeking to understand each other. Because the trouble with this kind of stuff is it feels very high stakes, doesn't it? Like particularly right now, we're in the lead up to the US election. Even as you probably heard, I was answering that question, I could feel myself tensing up, right? Here is a very deep disagreement about what we both really care about. Is it possible to stay connected? Is it possible to stay seeing each other as fully human across this disagreement? And I was inspired, and you'll hear later in the series, or perhaps earlier, an interview with Daryl Davis, who is someone who is able to build friendship across extremely deep difference, and listen to people who hold radically different views from him and do it with this grace and compassion and see real transformation in it. So I am very committed to the fact it should be possible to listen and seek to understand, even at this level of difference. But I wasn't quite brave enough today to really push it. And I'm left pondering that. I'm left pondering many things, frankly, but I won't. I won't burden you with them all. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast made by the think tank Theos. You can check out Theos's wider work at our website, and also do listen into our sister podcast hosted by my friend Nick Spencer called Reading Our Times. Our production team are Lizzie Harvey, Dan Turner, and Amari Yagandran, and our music is by Luke Stanley with vocals by Lizzie Harvey. Look forward to speaking to you next time.